Welcome to the Maine Historical Society podcast. These podcasts explore the experiences of Maine people in a changing world and the connections between local, state, and national history. To learn more about our programs, please visit us online at www.mainehistory.org/programs.
Thank you all so much for coming tonight. My name is Kate McBrien. I'm the Chief Curator and Director of Public Engagement here at Maine Historical Society. And I am very pleased to introduce author Tom Huntington tonight to talk to us about his new book, Maine Roads to Gettysburg. To give you a little bit of background, Tom is a Maine native, grew up in the Augusta area, and he's the author of a couple of other books as well. Searching for George Gordon Meade, the Forgotten Victor of Gettysburg, as well as another book, Guide to Gettysburg Battlefield Monuments, and Pennsylvania Civil War Trails, and Ben Franklin's Philadelphia. And this is his latest book that we are all so excited to hear about tonight, because as we all know, Maine holds the Civil War very close, and of course, especially Gettysburg, because of our beloved Joshua Chamberlain. Tom is also the former editor of American History and Historic Traveler magazines, and his writing has appeared in many publications, including Smithsonian, Air and Space, American Heritage, Innovation and Technology, British Heritage, and Yankee. So while he was born and bred in Augusta, he now lives in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania, which is very close to Gettysburg. So it put him in a great position for this book. So thank you all so much for being here, and let's give Tom a warm welcome.
Well, thanks everyone for coming out tonight. I'm competing with an absolutely gorgeous evening, so I know what temptations are out there, so I really do appreciate you coming here. This is a great turnout. This is the first night of our Maine vacation, so this is a great way to spend it. I am a Maine native, proud of that. I grew up in Augusta. I do live in Pennsylvania now, the state that tries to steal credit for the whoopie pie. But we're not going to let them get away with that, are we? So in a way, writing this book was like coming home. I had written about George Gordon Meade, who was he was from Pennsylvania. And I thought it was about time I wrote about people from my own state. And especially with Joshua Chamberlain's, you know, prominent position in Civil War history, I thought I had a good centerpiece for the book. But I did want to tell about a lot more about the other Maine soldiers who had fought at Gettysburg. And I wanted to follow them through the war to find out how they got to Gettysburg and their experiences before they got to Gettysburg. However, I do open the book with none other than let's see if I push the right button here. Joshua Chamberlain. He is, I think it's safe to say, Maine's most famous Civil War veteran. But I opened the book not with him at Little Round Top, but I opened the book with him in 1889 when he returned to Gettysburg with a lot of other Maine veterans to dedicate the monuments on the battlefield. And I'll be showing you pictures of those monuments as we go through the talk tonight. In 1889, he was 61 years old. He was had been the governor of Maine. He had been the president of Bowdoin College. But he was, in 1863, the colonel of the 20th Maine, and he fought that valiant defense of Little Round Top on July 2nd of 1863. And he told the people who had gathered to hear him at Gettysburg, he said, "Wherever there was a front, the guns of Maine thundered and her colors stood." Because Maine did play a prominent role in the Civil War. It had the highest number of soldiers per capita in the Union armies. Now, of course, the population of Maine was relatively small at that time, but nonetheless, it's something to be proud of. I think there were something like 73,000 Maine soldiers who fought in the war. Another speaker that night was Charles Hamlin, and he was the son of Hannibal Hamlin, who was the Maine-born Vice President of the United States. He was Lincoln's first Vice President. Charles Hamlin, his son, had served as an adjutant to General Andrew Humphreys, who commanded a division of the Third Corps at Gettysburg. And Hamlin told the veterans, he said, "We do not claim a monopoly of the glory won on this field," he says, "but it was with justifiable pride we note the pivotal points made memorable by the presence and conspicuous valor of Maine soldiers." And it would be an exaggeration to say that Maine soldiers won the Battle of Gettysburg, but they certainly did play an important role, as these men knew. Whoops, let's go back here. This is a gathering of the 20th Maine veterans on Little Round Top in 1889 when they dedicated their monument. And it's funny, I just found out that there's a group in Gettysburg that are going to recreate this photograph in 1889 in October with people that are going to fill every position in that photograph in the exact same spot, and they're going to take the picture again. So I hope to be one of the new people in that picture in October. Another person who spoke in 1889 at Gettysburg was Selden Connor, and he had been in command of the 7th Maine at Gettysburg. The 7th Maine did not do a great deal at Gettysburg. It was in the 6th Corps. It was in reserve. I think it suffered 2 casualties during the entire battle. But the 6th Corps actually just being on the field was actually a great help for the Army of the Potomac. They provided a very important reserve force. You can find their monument on the battlefield at a place called the Lost Avenue. It's called Neal Avenue, and it's probably the least visited part of the battlefield today. It's surrounded by private property. It's very difficult to find and very difficult to get to, but it's a really great place to visit, and that's what their monument looks like. In 1889, Connor said, he said, in proportion to the number of her troops in the action, no one of the 18 states whose regiments flew the Stars and Stripes in this hard-fought field contributed more than Maine to the victory. At whatever point the battle raged, the sons of the Pine Tree State were in the melee. And that's what I think what drew me to this story is I realized you can kind of tell the story of the 3 days of the battle at Gettysburg by telling the story of Maine regiments or Maine individuals who are at these pivotal points during the battle. And we'll talk about some of those as we go through this. Because it seemed like they were everywhere. They really did play an important role. But when Maine entered the war in 1861, when the Civil War broke out with the firing of Fort Sumter, Maine, like the rest of the United States, was woefully unprepared. The governor was Israel Washburn. He was inaugurated in January of 1861. I think he bears an uncanny resemblance to Stephen King. He came from a very interesting family. He had a number of very prominent brothers. One was Elihu Washburn, who actually added an E to his last name because he thought it looked more British. And Elihu was an Illinois congressman during the war, and he became the political patron of an obscure soldier named Ulysses S. Grant. And it's largely thanks to Washburn's influence in Washington that really played a role in Grant's rise in prominence during the war. And he had another brother who was a brigadier general from Wisconsin. And he had another brother who was on a gunboat in the James River during McClellan's Peninsula campaign. So they were all over the place, these Washburn brothers. In fact, there's a story that one night they got together and they were arguing about who had the most distinguished career, and they decided to put it to a secret ballot. And it was a tie vote because they had all voted for each other. But he was a very good and effective wartime governor. At that point, the governor served 1-year terms, so he served 2 1-year terms during the most critical periods of the war. He was helped a great deal by his very effective Adjutant General John Hodgson, who was born in Livermore. He was born John Littlefield. He changed his name to Hodgson when his widowed mother remarried. And he was a very effective Adjutant General. He was the man responsible for all the bureaucracy necessary to raise regiments and get them ready for war. And one of the great resources I use for this book is in the archives in Washington, in Augusta. They have the Civil War Regimental Correspondence, which is thousands of letters, every regiment represented. And most of them were sent to Hodgson. And there were people who wanted appointments as officers in regiments, or mothers asking if he'd heard anything of their sons who hadn't been heard from since a battle. Complaints about the equipment, and occasionally you came across some really interesting stories from soldiers who fought for Maine in the war. And one of his contemporaries said, it is universally conceded among military men that Maine had, in the person of John Hodgson, the most efficient adjutant general to be found in the North. But when the war began, Hodgson took a look at what Maine was prepared to offer to the cause. And he said he found Maine as little prepared to furnish troops for maintaining the integrity of the Union as it is possible to conceive. So he definitely had his work cut out for him when the war broke out. One of the soldiers that these two men had to deal with was William Higgins. This is one of the stories I found in the regimental correspondence. Higgins was a second sergeant in the 3rd Maine, and he was quite upset when he found out that only first sergeants were issued sidearms. He had a musket, he did not like it, and he wanted to get a pistol. So he wrote to the governor of Maine, and he said, "I ask you, as you are the governor of my state, to send me a Navy revolver from the arsenal as a present from yourself, which I will promise to use faithfully in defense of my country." Well, there's no record whether Israel Washburn actually went down to the arsenal and procured a pistol for William Higgins. I think he probably didn't. But Higgins ended the war as a lieutenant, so at that point he was eligible to get that sidearm that he wanted so badly. So I hope he did get it. One of the soldiers I talk about a great deal actually never fought at Gettysburg. This is Hiram Berry, who came from Rockland. I found him to be a very interesting figure. I call him my Janet Leigh character. If you've seen the movie Psycho, Janet Leigh was a prominent actress, and Hitchcock cast her in Psycho, and the audience expected that Janet Leigh was going to survive until the end credits. Instead, Hitchcock killed her off like a half an hour into the movie. With Hiram Berry, I wanted the readers to get the sense of this good man, this man who learned to be a soldier and turned out to be a very good soldier. By Chancellorsville, he was in command of a division. Some people thought he would definitely command a corps and maybe even become commander of the Army of the Potomac. Instead, he was shot by a sharpshooter at Chancellorsville and died. And he's now buried in Rockland. I find him to be a fascinating figure because his story showed how terrible the stresses of war could be. He commanded a brigade on the peninsula during McClellan's campaign, and was so used up that his hair started falling out in clumps. He probably had malaria. He had to go home to Rockland to recuperate, which he did. And he returned to the Army in time to fight the Battle of Fredericksburg. And he still was commanding a brigade. His men loved him, respected him. In fact, one of the letters I found in the research here at the Maine Historical Society was from a soldier on the peninsula who described an encounter with General Berry. The soldiers were digging ditches in the rain. It was wet. They were filthy. And Berry rode up, and he saw his soldier dripping wet. And he asked him if he had any dry clothes in his tent. And the soldier said he had. And Berry said, "Well, as soon as possible opportunity change into them, or you're going to get sick." And then he rode off, and the soldier turned to a Maine man and said, "What kind of a general is that? I've never been spoken to by a general like that before." And the Maine man who wrote this letter said, "That's just General Berry. That is his way. He looks out for his men." He was a good man, but at Fredericksburg, he was so shaken by watching his men die, he went up to Elijah Walker, who commanded the 4th Maine, which was Berry's original regiment, and was his former business partner from Rockland. And he put his head on his shoulder, and he sobbed so hard he could not even speak. And then two aides ushered him away, and within a half an hour, he was back on horseback directing his troops as though nothing had happened. And I think at that point, people did not know what PTSD was. They did not understand the mental conflicts of war. But I think had Berry survived the war, who knows what his mental state would have been afterwards. I just found him to be a fascinating figure in his end to be just a tragic end for the Union Army. I talk about someone else who perhaps was not as good a general as Hiram Berry could have been. But still, another very interesting figure. This, of course, is Oliver Otis Howard, who was from Leeds, Maine. He attended Bowdoin College, and then he went to West Point. So he had two colleges that he graduated from. He was a very pious man. He had a religious conversion before the war, and he was stationed in Florida. After that, he became known as the Christian General. His men called him something maybe a little less flattering. They called him Old Prayer Book. He had a brother who was a minister, Roland. Roland felt compelled to write to his brother, the general, and ask him to stop preaching to his troops because he was overdoing it and he was going to lose their respect. I don't know if he took any of that advice to heart. Of course, at Chancellorsville, Howard was in command of the 11th Corps, which is on the far right of the Union Army. And he disregarded many warnings to watch out for his right flank, that something was going on his right. At that point, it wasn't anchored on anything, just some brush and woods, which he thought would be protection enough. Well, it wasn't. Stonewall Jackson unleashed this very famous flank attack, routed the 11th Corps. It was the poor men of the 11th Corps, largely Germans and German-Americans, who bore the brunt of the ridicule for their rout at Chancellorsville. But it was largely Howard's fault for disregarding the recommendations that he watch out for his right. So when he arrived at Gettysburg, he was, I think, hoping to find some kind of redemption. And the fact that he does have a statue on Cemetery Hill says maybe he did earn a little bit of that. The one important thing that Howard did is he posted a reserve on Cemetery Hill on the first day of the battle. His superior officer, John F. Reynolds, had been killed early in the fighting on the first day. So Howard was now the commanding officer on the field. That's one thing he did. He posted a reserve on Cemetery Hill, and that provided the nucleus for the Union Army when they had to fall back after a bad first day of fighting. If Howard had not posted that reserve there, who knows what would have happened. And to the end of his days, he said that was his idea. There were other people who said John Reynolds sent him an order telling him to post a reserve on Cemetery Hill, and he said that did not happen. He never received any word from Reynolds to do that. It was on his own initiative that he picked that point for his reserve force. And I tend to believe Howard. I mean, he may have been a mediocre general, but I think he was an honest man, and he was a brave man. He lost his right arm at the Battle of Fair Oaks during the Peninsula Campaign. And there were stories soldiers saw him when he wanted to position a regiment. He planted their flag into the stump of his right arm and brought it over to the wall where he wanted it and put it down and told them to form there. So he did not perform terribly well at Gettysburg. He did really poorly at Chancellorsville. But later in the war, under General Sherman, he did prove to be an effective general. A very interesting individual, Bowdoin College has scanned and posted online all of his letters that he wrote throughout his lifetime, including his Civil War letters, which are fascinating reading and very touching. He had children at home, and he'd draw little pictures of camp life to show them what Papa was experiencing during the war. So you definitely see the human dimension of Oliver Howard in those letters. This gentleman was also with the 11th Corps at Gettysburg. This is Adelbert Ames. He was from Rockland. He was the son of a sea captain. He had been on sailing voyages before the war. It seemed like he was destined for a life at sea, but he went to West Point instead. When the war broke out, he was in an artillery unit. He was badly wounded at First Bull Run, and he would later receive the Medal of Honor for his actions there. And after that, he requested a position in the infantry. There was very little room for advancement in the artillery. It was very slow to get promotions in the artillery. And he was an ambitious man, so he did get command of a unit that was the 20th Maine. This is the man who taught Joshua Chamberlain the art of war. He was a very strict disciplinarian. Tom Chamberlain, Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain's brother, wrote back home to his sister, and he said, "Colonel A takes the men out to drill, and he will dam them uphill and down. I tell you, he is about as savage a man as you ever saw. I swear the men will shoot him the first battle they are in." Instead, I think what happened was the men appreciated that discipline the first battle they were in when they realized that because of Ames's drilling, that they were actually a cohesive unit who could perform well on the field and did perform well on the field. I know Joshua Chamberlain certainly appreciated what Ames had done. The two men would study drill tactics in Ames' tent at night as Joshua Chamberlain, a college professor with no military experience, learned how you handle men in battle. He was, you know, a student in the art of war, and Ames was his teacher. Ames is a great story. He was the oldest surviving general when he died in the 1930s at the age of, I think, 97. And when he was in his 90s, he would play 36 holes of golf a day. And his golfing partner was John D. Rockefeller of Standard Oil fame. There's a great story about his granddaughter, Blanche. His daughter, Blanche, was his biographer. And when John F. Kennedy wrote Profiles in Courage, he mentioned Ames's tenure as a governor of Mississippi after the war during Reconstruction. And Kennedy said that he ruled Mississippi at the point of a bayonet. And Blanche Ames, his daughter, was outraged by this and wrote to Senator Kennedy and said, please change that in your next edition. And Kennedy, in typical self-deprecating way, said, I don't think there will be any other editions. But of course, there were lots of other editions, and he never changed it. And Blanche Ames never stopped writing to him to change it, even when he was president. So when Ames's grandson, the writer George Plimpton, visited the White House one day, Kennedy took him aside and said, will you talk to your grandmother about the letters? They're starting to cut into the business of government. So, Ames, fascinating, fascinating individual. And he was with the 11th Corps during the fighting on the first day, and he commanded a brigade, and his division commander was wounded, Francis Barlow, and Ames took command of the division for the rest of the battle. One of the first Maine units to get involved in the fight was the 2nd Maine Battery, commanded by this guy, James Hall. And you can see their monument along the Chambersburg Pike. And they were brought up early in the fighting on the first day. John F. Reynolds positioned them himself in a position that Hall thought was a little too advanced for artillery, but he was promised he'd receive support. Well, as the fighting got hotter, the support fell back. And Hall, and he said in his report, and you can kind of sense his temper here, said, as this position was considered too advanced for infantry, I thought it was too advanced for artillery as well. So he fell back as well. He almost lost one gun, but he actually went back on the field and recovered it, because you don't want to lose your guns. That's shameful. And then he wrote to John Hodgson, the adjutant general we saw earlier, in a letter that's in the Regimental Correspondence. And he said, the boys fought like the devil, never better. You may judge when I tell you that many of our horses were not shot but bayoneted, that it was a close and desperate struggle for our guns, two of which they actually had hold of at one time. I've seen hard fighting before and been badly smashed up, but I never saw a battery taken from the field and its guns saved in so bad a state as the old 2nd came off that day. So a very, very, very hard fight by the 2nd Maine Battery. But I think my favorite story of Maine soldiers from Gettysburg comes from the 5th Maine Battery. And this is the story of Charles O. Hunt, who I think he bears an uncanny resemblance to John Lennon. So I think we have a lot of reincarnation going on here. But Charles Hunt, he was a Bowdoin graduate. And he graduated in the spring of 1861. War broke out. And Hunt had a decision to make. He was also from Gorham, so he's from around here. Should he join the Army? At this point, there was no draft, so it was all volunteer. Or should he continue his medical studies? So he decided he was going to stay with his sister while he thought it over. And so he went down and stayed at her house all through the fall of 1861. And she lived in a little town in Pennsylvania called Gettysburg. So he spent the fall of 1861 exploring Gettysburg. He wrote later that he collected horse chestnuts on Culp's Hill. He rode through the wheat field. He rode through the peach orchard. At which point, none of these places had any distinction whatsoever. And he finally decided, I will join the Army, and he joined the 5th Maine Battery. So on July 1st, 1863, his battery is riding up towards Gettysburg, and he goes to his commander, Greenleaf Stevens, and he says, if I get hurt, I hope it happens here, because I know they will take care of me. Well, as they say, you better be careful what you wish for, because he was wounded during the first day's fighting. A Confederate shell fragment went through his holster and into his thigh, carrying a piece of his pistol with it. And so he was too badly wounded to fight, so he went to Stevens and he asked if he could go to his sister's house. which he was granted permission. They hoisted him up on a horse, and he rode through all the fighting to the middle of Gettysburg. His sister lived right off the town square next to the bank where her husband worked. And there he found like 14 people and two dogs hiding in the bank vault. And he joined them for the duration of the first day's fighting. And he stayed with them for the next 2 days, wondering, just trying to decipher by the noise of the battle who was winning. And that massive cannonade on July 3rd, which preceded Pickett's charge, he said, shook the building to its foundations. And then on July 4th, when one of the house servants found out that the Confederates had abandoned the town, this rumor swept through Gettysburg that the Confederates were going to shell the town and reduce it to rubble before they left. And Hunt's sister, in a panic, decided she was going to borrow a wheelbarrow and wheel him out of town before that could happen. And he said he disabused her of that notion that that would ever happen. And fortunately, there was no need for that indignity. So Hunt went back home to Gorham to recuperate, rejoin the army, and then in 1864, he was captured. And he later wrote about this great escape attempt he made with two other Maine soldiers from a prison camp in North Carolina. And they came within a few miles of Union lines before they were recaptured. He described on election day, November of 1864, the escaped soldiers sat down, they were hiding in the brush, and they had their own presidential election, and it was a unanimous decision for Abraham Lincoln. And then Hunt went on to become the head surgeon at the Portland General Hospital, which is where he was when he died. And he hand wrote these two very thick volumes in which he transcribed all his Civil War letters and then filled in the gaps in the narrative himself. And they're in the collections at Bowdoin College, and they're just fascinating reading. He really has some incredible experiences. So that's one of my favorite stories from a main unit at Gettysburg. You've probably heard of Charles Tilden in the 16th Maine. That's their monument on Oak Ridge in Gettysburg. Tilden, they had became known as the Blanket Brigade. When they first reached the army, they were hustled out of Washington, D.C. and to catch up with the Army of the Potomac to catch Lee on his Maryland campaign. And they were told, just leave your knapsacks and your tents and your equipment behind, we'll send it after you. This is in August. It was never sent after them. They did not get it until Thanksgiving Day. Some of them had no underwear. They had some of them had no overcoats, no tents. In weather that was so cold, the water was literally freezing in their canteens. So the unit was decimated by disease. They lost hundreds of men. And they finally got their equipment on Thanksgiving Day, which they thought was a great cause for Thanksgiving. They became known as the Blanket Brigade because they were shivering beneath their tiny army blankets, and the other regiments would jeer at them as the Blanket Brigade. But at Gettysburg, they were part of the First Corps, which was being crushed on two sides by Confederate attacks, and it was forced to fall back to Cemetery Hill, where Oliver Howard had posted that reserve. Their division commander, John Robinson, rode up to Tilden, who was from Castine, and ordered him to an advanced position and said, hold that at all hazards. Tilden knew this was suicide, and he asked him to repeat the order, which he did. So Tilden turned to his men and said, you know what that means? And as one soldier wrote, it meant death or capture. And every man realized it perfectly. One of the soldiers in that unit was Abner Small, who was from Waterville. He had started the war with the 3rd Maine, fought with them in First Bull Run, but he was now the adjutant of the 16th Maine. He wrote a posthumous account of his experience, which is fascinating reading. He's a very entertaining writer, and he also wrote a history of his regiment. This is the marker that stands at Gettysburg at their advanced position that they were told to hold. Well, they couldn't hold it for long. It was impossible. As Small wrote, he said, we were sacrificed to steady the retreat. They had to just hold off the rebels long enough for the rest of the division to get back into town and out of harm's way. Another soldier described it as like a pair of scissors closing shut, and the 16th Maine was sent to in between the blades to keep them from closing. They knew they were doomed, so the men got together And they decided they would not allow their flags to fall into enemy hands. This is just would be just shameful. So instead, they tore them into shreds, and they distributed the pieces among them, and people would hide them in their pockets or underneath a shirt. And Abner Small wrote, "These fragments were carried through southern prisons and finally home to Maine, where they are still treasured as precious relics more than a quarter century after Gettysburg." And he wrote that in 1889. Now, Small wasn't captured at Gettysburg. He was captured later in Petersburg and was thrown into Libby Prison in Richmond. And when I was doing research here at the Maine Historical Society, they have his scrapbooks. And I was going through his scrapbooks, and I turned the page, and I found the star that he had saved from the flag at Gettysburg, which I just thought was just amazing to come face to face with that. It's like history just, you know, came alive for me. So that's the kind of cool thing that you sometimes encounter when you're doing research. I mean, they have wonderful things here in the collections. Abner Small's book, The Roads to Richmond, is just fascinating reading. He's very sardonic. He's got a very modern voice, kind of a jaundiced eye, you could say. Another unit that fought at Gettysburg was the 3rd Maine. This was commanded by Moses Lakeman, who was what we call an out-of-stater. He was actually from Boston, but he was the nephew of the mayor of Hollowell. And he eventually became the commander of the 3rd Maine. This is their monument in the peach orchard. They actually had two fights at Gettysburg on July 2nd, the second day. They advanced with some sharpshooters to a thing called Pitzer's Woods, which was an advanced position. And there had been some Confederate activity witnessed in there, and General Daniel Sickles, who commanded the 3rd Corps, wanted to find out what was going on in Pitzer's Woods. So he had the 3rd Maine and the sharpshooters go there, and they got a little skirmish with some Alabama soldiers. And this was reported to Sickles. Now, Sickles was already very worried about what was going on in front of him for various reasons, which would be another lecture in and of itself. But he decided to move the 3rd Corps forward to an advanced position where he's not supposed to be. It was exposed. It was too long to defend adequately. And one reason he did that was because of the reports about what happened with the 3rd Maine in Pitzer's Woods. So you could say, in effect, they might have been responsible for that. And then they did some fierce fighting in the peach orchard, attacked on two sides and forced to fall back. Lakeman did lose his flag. He said he did not realize it until they had retreated. He said, if I had, they would have had me and my little squad, or I would have had my flag. I found Lakeman to be another one of these fascinating characters to come across. I found his pension records in the National Archives. And pension records can tell you all kinds of interesting things. And it turns out that either he developed a fondness for drink or he already had a fondness for drink. But he had some issues in 1864. He was actually brought up on charges because he was upset when his lieutenant colonel, his second command, Edwin Burt, he thought he was usurping his authority and doing things that Lakeman was supposed to be doing. And Lakeman, apparently under the influence of drink, loudly declared that Burt did not run this machine and that he, Moses Lakeman, did. And then he loudly proclaimed, and you'll have to pardon my language here, that Burt is a damned, 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 goddamned son of a bitch. Even worse, Burt testified that whenever he looked in Lakeman's direction, Lakeman would make faces at him. But apparently the charges did stick. Lakeman did remain in command of the regiment until he was mustered out in 1864. There was another incident in September when he was drunk at a theater in Baltimore and was loudly denouncing General Lew Wallace. And he was arrested for that offense, but apparently once he sobered up and apologized to the general, they let him go. But he was here in 1889 for the dedication of the monument, so. Well, he must have been an interesting man to sit down and have a drink with. The 17th Maine fought in the wheat field. And this is actually one of my favorite monuments on the battlefield. They fought behind a stone wall on the wheat field. And that's, you can see the soldier on the top of their monument is behind the stone wall. It's a really cool monument. One of their soldiers was Charles Maddox. He was another out-of-stater because he was born in Vermont, but he did move to Maine when his mother married a local man. He was another Bowdoin College student. He was actually one of Joshua Chamberlain's pupils at Bowdoin. And as soon as he graduated in 1862, he joined the 17th Maine. And he was young, he was ambitious, he was intelligent, but he was also that kind of officer that the enlisted men tended not to like very much. As one of them said, he said, "I can't think of any officer I'd sooner part with," for he was very pompous and had yards and yards of superfluous red tape about him. But he was a brave man and a hard fighter, and when he was behind the stone wall at on the wheat field, he had two men loading muskets for him, and then he'd pop up over the wall and blaze away with the preloaded muskets. And he was one of the men that Charles O. Hunt from Gorham, who was wounded at Gettysburg, escaped with from that prison camp in North Carolina, Charles Maddox. So it was a small world in Civil War Maine. Elijah Walker, I mentioned him when we talked about Hiram Berry. He had been Berry's business partner in Rockland, and when Berry was advanced to brigade command, Walker got command of the 4th Maine. And at Gettysburg, they fought in Devil's Den, and that's their monument there. That's Little Round Top in the background. That's not the part of Little Round Top where the 20th Maine fought, though. The 20th Maine was kind of around the corner and on the southern slopes. Walker was one of those flinty, suffer no fool gladly kind of New Englander you find quite often. He was a married man with 7 children, but nonetheless, he enlisted to fight with the Union, and eventually did become the commander of the 4th Maine. Now, they were defending a battery, a New York battery in the Devil's Den, and the commander of that battery did not want them behind him. He said he wanted Walker to take his men all the way down to the left of Devil's Den, and to which Walker replied, "I would not go into that den if I was obliged to." So the battery commander complained to his brigade commander, who gave Walker orders to obey the artilleryman. Walker said, "I remonstrated with all the power of speech I could command, and only, as I then stated, obeyed because it was a military order." It ended up that he had to dash back to his old position when the battery was attacked, and got into a furious struggle. This was James Smith's 4th New York Battery, and you can see that monument on top of Devil's Den, very prominent position. During the fighting, Walker was shot. His Achilles tendon was nearly severed. His horse was killed. A Confederate yanked his sword from his hand, but with the help of some of his men, he was able to get it back. And he did not lose his flag. He said, "Our flag was pierced by 32 bullets and 2 pieces of shell, and its staff was shot off, but Sergeant Henry O. Ripley, its bearer, did not allow the color to touch the ground, nor did he receive a scratch. So all the others of the color guard were killed or wounded." So it was serious fighting in Devil's Den. And at that point, 4th Maine was at the far left of the Union line, because there was no one occupying Little Round Top at that point. There were just some Union signalmen up there. When Meade, General Meade's chief engineer, Gouverneur Warren, went up on Little Round Top and realized that after Dan Sickles had moved all his men forward, there was no one protecting Little Round Top, he sent out orders to find someone who could come up there and guard that hill. And the commander of the 5th Corps sent orders to a division commander to send one of his brigades. Well, Strong Vincent intercepted that messenger. And Strong Vincent commanded a brigade that included the 20th Maine. And Vincent, on his own authority, ordered his brigade to Little Round Top, and that's how the 20th Maine got to the place where it became so famous. These are two men who fought on Little Round Top of the 20th Maine, Samuel Keene and Ellis Speer. Speer was a teacher from Wiscasset, and he was an acting major at Little Round Top. And he was on the regiment's left during the fighting. He remembered the uproar and earnest hot work. "I smelt the hot smoke. The faces of the men were set. How they worked." Keene was a lawyer in Rockland. He had been married for only 4 months when he joined the Army. And he kept a very meticulous diary during his wartime experience. He'd record the weather. He'd record the letters he received, the people he talked to. He'd complain about feeling blue a lot, how much he missed Maine. On June 22, 1864, Samuel Keene was shot by a Confederate sharpshooter, and he died in Ella Spears' arms. And when Ella Spears' first wife died in 1874, he married Samuel Keene's widow. So once again, Maine Civil War was a small, tight-knit community. Another man of the 20th Maine was Holman Melcher, and he was from Topsom. He was a farm boy. He graduated from the Maine State Seminary, which later became Bates College. And he was mustered to the 20th Maine as a corporal. And he was 21 years old, and he was working as a teacher. Now, I'm sure you've heard about the bayonet charge, in which the 20th Maine finally stormed down the slope of the Little Round Top, almost out of ammunition, routed the Alabamians who were attacking them, and ended the fight. Well, some people said it was actually Holman Melcher who started that bayonet charge. He was with the Color Guard, and he had noticed that some of the wounded men had fallen in front of their line, so they were stuck between the Maine boys and the Alabama boys. So he went to Chamberlain and asked if he could move his Color Guard forward and protect those men. Chamberlain said he told Melcher to wait, that he was going to do just that thing in just a few minutes. But according to some accounts, Melcher just moved forward on his own initiative. Someone later said, with a cheer and a flash of his sword, that sent an inspiration along the line. Full 10 paces to the front, he sprang. 10 paces, more than half the distance between the hostile lines. "Come on, come on, come on, boys," he shouts. And the men, seeing this movement of part of their regiment, followed in kind, and it turned into a motion of the whole regiment as they plunged down that hill. And they were able to push back the Alabamians. Now, William Oates, who commanded the 15th Alabama, who was attacking the 20th Maine, said he had already ordered his men to retreat. And he said the bayonet charge did not convince them. It was already happening. That's the fight. that's the fight at Little Round Top. There were so many different accounts. I call it like the Rashomon of the Civil War, which that Akira Kurosawa movie where every participant remembers an event differently. It's a fascinating study about perception and reality. But it was a rout of the Alabamians. Even William Oates said they ran like a herd of wild cattle. And one reason for that was because of this man and his men, Walter Morrill of Company B. As soon as Chamberlain had reached Little Round Top, he sent Morrill out as skirmishers. And they marched off into the woods, and as far as Chamberlain knew, they disappeared. He didn't know what happened to them. But as the 20th Maine was charging down the hill, Morrill and his men rose up from behind this stone wall on the left and fired into the Confederates' flank. So that completely finished the rout of the Alabamians. They could not withstand that fire. He had been a lumberman. He had been a slate cutter. He had been described as the coolest man we had in the regiment in an emergency and had no superior on the skirmish line. And another sergeant said that Morrill was a man in every sense of the word. He will look out for his boys, as he calls them now. So a good soldier, steady and dependable. And you can still see this monument. It's hard to find. It doesn't get visited a lot, but it's off in the woods to the east of Little Round Top, to the east of the main 20th main monument there. Another main man who had a huge impact on the battle was Freeman McGilvery. He was an artilleryman. He was a sea captain before the war. He commanded ships, but he joined the Army and became an artilleryman. And he had been in command of the 6th Maine Battery until he was promoted to a brigade in the artillery reserve. Now, the man that expected to be his replacement was Edwin Dow. But McGilvery was determined that Dow would not receive command. And these are some of the letters I found in that Civil War regimental correspondence in Augusta. McGilvery wrote that Dow was frequently intoxicated on duty. When Dow heard about this, he was outraged. He got the men in the battery to sign a petition in his favor and send it to the governor. But then some of the men wrote separately to the governor and said, "Yeah, we signed that petition, but we don't want you to use that to give Dow command of the battery. We just don't want to stain his character in any way." Dow also wrote and complained that when he was out of out of camp, McGilvery rode in and harangued the men into a state of near mutiny. And this is a letter that Dow had added a lot of underlinings, and that he was going to press charges against McGilvery for trying to induce a mutiny among his men. So things were in a pretty bad state of affairs between these two men. And then in June, McGilvery wrote to the governor and said, essentially, you know, all that stuff I said, forget it. You just make your own decision. And it turned out that two other battery commanders had been conspiring to deny McGilvery a promotion that he felt he deserved. And Dow was the one who informed him of that. It was Greenleaf Stevens and James Hall, the 5th Maine and the 2nd Maine Battery. So McGilvery wrote to the governor about this ingenious scheme. And now it seemed like everyone in every Maine battery was feuding with each other. And I'm sure the governor of Maine would just put his head on his desk when the mail arrived every day. But on July 2nd at Gettysburg, because Dan Sickles had moved his men forward and George Meade had to send all these units to reinforce Sickles' beleaguered line, there were huge gaps in the Maine Union defensive line on Cemetery Hill. And McGilvery spotted one of these gaps late in the day of July 2nd. And just as the Confederates of William Barksdale's Mississippi Brigade were approaching, there was no defense. They could split the Union line in two. So McGilvery did what he could to cobble together an artillery line, just get as many cannon as he could, and put them there and just hold off the Confederates long enough for reinforcements to arrive. And that's exactly what he did. And one of the batteries he found was Edwin Dow. And Dow put together whatever personal feelings he might be having, and he did as he was told. And in his official report, he wrote, "I deem it due to Major McGilvery to say that he was ever present, riding up and down in the line of the thickest fire, encouraged the men by his words and dashing example, his horse receiving 8 wounds, of which he has since died, the gallant major himself receiving only a few scratches." And this was a vital maneuver by McGilvery. He could very well have saved the Army of the Potomac at Gettysburg on July 2nd. Of course, the great irony is McGilvery died in 1864. He received a slight shrapnel wound on one finger, which became infected. And he was having it amputated, and the anesthesia killed him on the operating table. So is that an irony of war or what? Another great story from a battery, it's the story of John Chase of Augusta. He was another one in the 5th Maine Battery, that's Charles O. Hunt's unit. And you can see their monument in what is known as Stevens Knoll now. Chase had performed admirably at Chancellorsville. His gun had been reduced to 2 men, himself and a corporal, and just the 2 men together were keeping that gun firing until it became so intense that Winfield Scott Hancock saw how desperate their situation was. He sent the Irish Brigade over to bail them out. I think Chase later said something like, "I never loved an Irishman until then, and now no one loves an Irishman more." On July 1st, he had a religious conversion. He said he had never prayed before, but he was overcome with religious feeling, and he fell to his knees and prayed for the first time in his life. Now, God has a very strange way of answering his prayers, because on July 2nd, a shell burst within feet of him, tore off an arm, tore out an eye, left him with 47 other wounds. You can see all the wounds on his body there. His comrades in the battery left him for dead. They thought he was dead. And he lay on the ground until July 4th when they were recovering bodies. And then a crew picked him up and was throwing him into a wagon for burial when he groaned and regained consciousness. And his first words were, "Did we win the battle?" Even then, no one believed he could live. His wounds became infected. He was actually left outside of a hospital to die. Sarah Sampson, a nurse from Maine, helped nurse him to health. And he eventually was returned to Maine, and he lived a long and healthy life. He married, he had children, he served as a messenger in the Maine House of Representatives, and he became an inventor with 47 patents to his name. His first one was a removable bustle for a hoop skirt. And this tells you something about the length of his life. His last one was for a flying machine. He said would be better than anything the Wright brothers could put in the air. And he died in 1914 in Florida. So it's a fascinating story of the resilience of the human spirit. But of course, infantry did fight at Gettysburg as well. And one of the units was the 19th Maine. And you can see this monument on Cemetery Ridge today. They were commanded by Francis Heath. He had a brother who had fought in the army, William, who had been a child prodigy. He had been around the world by the time he was 16. And he was killed at the Battle of Gaines' Mills on the peninsula. But at Gettysburg, Francis was in command of the 19th Maine. It had never fought a battle at this point on July 2nd. And late in the day on July 2nd, they were on Cemetery Ridge, and they could see Dan Sickles' Third Corps was being badly beaten and being forced back, and it was starting to retreat. And as that was happening, Winfield Scott Hancock the Superb, he was known as, the Second Corps commander and a man who performed heroic deeds at Gettysburg, rode up to the 19th Maine, took their color bearer, and moved him to exactly where he wanted in position, and said, can you stay here? And I think he replied something, I'll stay here till hell freezes over, or something like that. So as they saw the Third Corps retreating towards them, Heath ordered his men to lie on the ground because he didn't want them standing up where they would be swept away in the confusion of these retreating soldiers. And a general from the Third Corps rode up to him and ordered him to get his men up off the ground. And he said, refused. He was one of those Maine men like Elijah Walker. He's going to do what he thinks is right. And the general then ordered him to the rear. And he said, General, a general who outranks you told me to stay here, and I'm not going anywhere. So then the general rode down Heath's line, ordering his men up one by one. And Heath followed behind him, ordering them back down on the ground. And they were able to not get swept up. The Third Corps passed over them. Some of the men from the Third Corps were saying, follow us, boys, we're doomed. And other men were saying, we'll form in the rear, we'll help you out later. And Heath got his men together, and they performed a charge against the advancing Confederates and helped stop that advance late in the day on July 2nd. This is their first taste of combat. On July 3rd, they were the only Maine unit to materially participate in the repulse of Pickett's charge, which is considered the high water mark of the Confederacy in the end of the battle. They were still on Cemetery Hill, and the Confederates broke the Union line further down at the Bloody Angle, and eventually the 19th Maine was ordered to dash down and participate in the repulse. And one soldier recalled, we were all loading and firing and yelling and pushing towards the gap now filled with the exultant rebels. And so we kept on and on. Then suddenly I found myself rushing with all our crowd upon the enemy with an impetuosity that was irresistible. And the day was ours. And the day was. And that was the end of the Battle of Gettysburg. And so these soldiers from Maine were at pivot points throughout the entire battle, really played important roles. After the war, a soldier from the 19th Maine had heard Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain speaking about the role of the 20th Maine at the Battle of Gettysburg. And when the talk was over, he went up to Chamberlain and he said, I see, General, you claim that the 20th Maine saved the day at Gettysburg. And certainly, Chamberlain replied. Hitherto, the soldier said, I thought it was the 19th Maine that saved the day there. And Chamberlain replied, he said, and you thought rightly. He said, don't you know that every picket that sticks to the fence may claim the credit of keeping the pigs out of the garden? The 19th Maine decided that was a very simple and sensible explanation. So they all played their pivotal roles. But nonetheless, Chamberlain is hands down, the most famous Maine man to fight in the Civil War. He was helped by his prominent role in the novel, The Killer Angels, which was then made into the movie Gettysburg. He played a big role in the Ken Burns Civil War series, and it is a great story. I mean, he was a professor. He was not a military man. A professor who found that he was naturally skilled in the arts of war and fought a valiant defense in his first regimental command. He had been lieutenant colonel. So this was his first command of the 20th Maine on Little Round Top on July 2nd. And this, of course, is his monument, and that is not the real Joshua Chamberlain standing next to him. Though that is a man named Chamberlain. I think that's Ted Chamberlain. To me, it's something like the story of King Arthur, a young King Arthur pulling Excalibur out of the rock and discovering he's the king. Or Luke Skywalker finding out he really is a Jedi Knight. It's this professor of rhetoric at Bowdoin College discovered that he really was a soldier. And he proved it in the best way possible. And I will conclude with some of Chamberlain's words. He made a very famous speech in 1889 in Gettysburg. And you may have heard it before, but it's always worth hearing again. And this is, he was speaking to other veterans from Maine who had fought at Gettysburg. And he kind of captures, I think, why that battlefield in Pennsylvania still draws us down there. I'm not lucky that I don't live in Maine, but if I have to live in Pennsylvania, I'm lucky that I live 40 minutes from Gettysburg, and I do get down there as often as possible. And this is what Chamberlain said. He said, "In great deeds, something abides. On great fields, something stays. Forms change and pass. Bodies disappear. But spirits linger to consecrate ground for the vision place of souls. And reverent men and women from afar, and generations that know us not, and that we know not of, heart drawn to see where and by whom great things were suffered and done for them, shall come to this deathless field to ponder and dream, and lo, the shadow of a mighty presence shall wrap them in its bosom, and the power of the vision pass into their souls." If you have questions, I will endeavor to answer them to the best of my ability. Anyone? Good, I must have explained everything then. One way in the back.
So, can you speak to the complexion of the 20th Maine compared to where the soldiers from some of the other regiments came from?
Yeah, the 20th Maine was kind of unique in that it was put together for men all over the state. It was representative of all different portions. A lot of the regiments might have been more coastal, or they might have been more from Piscataquis County. But this was one of the last of, I guess, the third wave of regiments. At first, Maine raised 10, and then it raised 5 more, and then it raised the 16th. And then it decided it would raise these 4 more regiments. And the 20th was the last of that surge of regiment building. So it kind of got people from all over the place, which, I don't know. Maybe that's why people like to embrace, take the 20th Maine to their bosom so much, because it's all of us a part of that regiment. But it's, you know, it's a great story. If you read the John Pullen book, The 20th Maine, a great book. Tom DeJardin wrote a great book, Stand Firm, You Boys from Maine. People can't seem to get enough of the 20th Maine story. It is fascinating. One thing I didn't mention is nothing much to do with the 20th Maine, but during the course of researching this book, I learned that my great-grandfather was in the 31st Maine. He did not fight at Gettysburg. He enlisted at the age of 18 as a farm boy from Litchfield, and he fought for the rest of the war. I found his enlistment papers in the Regimental Correspondence in Augusta with his signature on it. I thought that was cool. I also discovered that buried in the same cemetery in Litchfield where he's buried is the flag bearer from the 20th Maine, Andrew Tozier, who actually also served as part of Chamberlain's household staff after the war. And Chamberlain personally fought to get Tozier awarded the Medal of Honor. So he shares the same burial ground as my humble private great-grandfather of the 31st Maine, which I thought was pretty nice too. Anything else?
It's the Huntington Hill in Litchfield. Would that be your name?
No, it's Litchfield. It's something Litchfield something cemetery. And the strange thing is, I would go there with my grandmother, my dad's mother, and my grandfather had died before I was born, and she had her stone there, just hadn't put the second date on it yet. And I would see this tombstone behind it with Huntington on it. And I say, "Wow, look at that. It says Huntington." And they just say, "Yeah, it does." So I found out on my own that that's my great-grandfather who fought in the Civil War. You know? So do some research. You never know what you might find. So. Okay, well, thank you again for coming out. I really enjoyed this. It's a great way to start a Maine vacation, so I appreciate it. And if you want me to sign books, I'll stay up front and sign books if you'd like me to sign a book for you.